Broadsheet Radio.
Cass, you ready? Leah, you ready? Rachel, you ready?
All right, boys. Let's go.
Let's go, girls. Welcome to Shared History. We're back. It's another episode. Cass thought that I was just singing for myself, but I decided to turn it into the intro. So,
so now I'm here. Shared History, the happiest place on earth.
I mean, it is if Shania's there. That's how I feel about it. And it, you know what? Today it is the happiest place on earth, because at long last, we have as our guests a couple human beings who I refer to as our podcast twins, only because we all born history podcasts into the universe, I think in like the same month of the same year. And yeah. you find the people who are on a similar journey at a similar time. And you follow them on social media, you like their posts, and you listen to their episodes, and you think that you know each other. Internet friends. That's what being a millennial is all about. So it took us forever to get them on here. That's our fault, not theirs. So let's get them in here. Rachel Lee Perez is a fun-loving, kind-hearted gal who loves coffee and long walks on the beach. If you catch her after a cocktail or two, you might find her passionately discussing one of two things, and these two things only. One, the erasure of women from history, or two, the various JonBenet Ramsey theories, which there are a lot of, so you could only talk about that for a very long time. And then also on the mic, Leo Alacones is an introverted extrovert, hard relate, who will take any and every opportunity to eat, drink, and spend time with friends. She's an event planner by day and an avid Netflix watcher by night, and is very passionate about font choices. Very. Welcome the hashtag History Gals.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
We did it. Cass is like dying.
We're so excited to be here.
Can I just say, Rachel, and not in a creepy way, I want to get you drunk. Although it sounds like you don't need to be drunk to talk about JonBenet Ramsey or the erasure of women in history.
Entirely unnecessary.
And Leah, you don't need to be drunk, but I want to hear you drunk talking about
font choices.
Font choices. I almost said grammar. Font choices.
No, Cass, I get you drunk to talk about grammar.
The funny thing is I'm so bad at grammar, truly, but I have very aggressive feelings about Oxford commas.
Oh, I got into a fight once with my parents about it.
Yes!
Okay, wait, hold on. Okay.
Hold on. This is really important. It might ruin my mic quality.
Wait, what?
Hold on. Can you see the very bottom sticker? Team Oxford comma.
Yep.
Okay. Cass, for or against?
Four.
Leah, for or against?
Four.
Great. How many of you guys write for a living in a situation where you don't get to choose the whether you're writing in AP style or Chicago manual?
No.
Me, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Who gives a fuck about an Oxford comma? Me. I do.
I would like... Is this a safe space to come out as not fully anti-Oxford comma, but anti-Oxford
Kick
comma
Who
when
let
it
her
is
in?
Not necessary?
Okay, well, it's going to be a really awkward podcast from here.
Yeah.
I could feel everyone's butthole just tighten a little bit and be like,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, there's some hostility, not going to lie.
But this is a safe space, unfortunately. So Natalie, welcome.
I'm for it when it is necessary for the clarity of the statement, and I'm against it when it isn't. And that's how I feel.
Give an example of when it's not necessary.
Oh, shit.
No, this is just curious.
If you're listing three things that aren't confusing, so if you're just saying you're going to the store and you're going to pick up apples, bananas, and oranges, you don't need the Oxford comma. Also, in AP style, you're not supposed to use it. And a lot of my clients work in AP style. So in my personal writing, I tend to use it, or at least that used to be the case. But I omit it.
I mean, don't write professionally. So it's all texting. I use a lot of commas. I live in the run-on sentence. Semicolons are my best friend.
Absolutely.
So sometimes it can be confusing because I've already got 12 commas in a sentence before an Oxford comma. But sometimes I feel like in that instance, it's necessary then. But I agree, if it's confusing the statement, you don't need it. But I'll always opt for.
I concur.
It's an unnecessary pause sometimes.
Yeah, way to start it off weird, Nat.
Yeah, I really am.
When the majority of the group is saying Team Oxford comma, you just got to nod your head and say, yeah. Yeah, me too. Definitely, yeah.
Natalie, we wanted hashtag history to like us, and it's starting off real awkward.
I will not stand idly by and change my opinions and punctuation to cater to my,
pressure.
To pander to my crowd.
Yeah.
That's where I stand. Also, historically speaking, the reason why AP style, the most popular, common, like German journalist style, doesn't use an Oxford comma is because it was one more thing that typesetters had to set. And they were like, anything that was an extra thing that they were like, that we can we not, can you not make us do that?
Natalie, I'm tired of your excuses. I'm tired of you doubling down.
I respect the historical aspect of it.
I don't know. This is some revisionist history as far as I'm
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, you know,
cite your source.
Let's just jump into it because if we don't get started, we could go on this forever.
I mean, passionate enough that it's on my laptop, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I secretly, I love you girls, and I know you're going to bring a great topic, but I secretly want to can it and just fight about the Oxford comma for 30 minutes.
It makes sense. It's actually perfect because the hashtag history podcast focuses on telling stories of history's greatest, like, controversies. And isn't this controversial?
Totally.
You know what? Natalie's actually pro Oxford comma. She just wanted a good segue.
I am very pro segue.
Well, thank you, though, for having us, even though you are not on the same team as the rest of us. We are really happy to be here because we've been following you all for a really long time, too. I do think that we started in the same month. We started in July 2019.
Yep.
Yep.
Same.
That's crazy. What is your anniversary date?
The 3rd. July 3rd.
That's crazy. Congratulations.
Thank you. I took Natalie on an all-inclusive honeymoon vacation.
I'm trying to remember what the 3-year anniversary is. I don't think it's cotton. It might be leather.
What is it?
I hope it's leather, Natalie. Wait for your delivery. You're getting leather stuff.
Yes, please. So happy anniversary to all of us. At time of recording, we are all freshly anniversed.
Yes.
Should we just dig right in?
Dig in. I've already made you guys my enemies, so let's let's share something other than an argument.
Well, I mean, this, you're right. This won't turn into an argument because we're all going to be on the same side of this awful topic, and that is just infuriated and depressed.
Mm-hmm. A natural state of being.
Yeah. See, so not too much of a shakeup here. What we're going to discuss on your podcast today is the forced sterilization of thousands of Latinas throughout the 20th century here in Leah and my home state of California.
So really just a light topic.
Yeah, just light.
Easy breezy over here.
Easy breezy. For sure. I mean, to be fair, that Oxford comma one did get pretty heated.
Thank God we're all going to be on the same side of this topic.
Yeah, 100%.
Cass, we have to take an ad break.
Fair enough.
But we're a history podcast, so we have to infuse this interlude with some tasty, tasty facts.
Okay. Oh, tasty facts. Like brewing beer using hops became a standard practice as a result of early drug laws in Bohemia.
Ah, yes. The Reinheitsgebot Law of 1516. I remember it well.
Now that hops are no longer a legally required ingredient in beer, welcome to the future, our friends at Herbiary have taken it upon themselves to release your taste buds from the cages of convention.
They've experimented with over 200 different herbs and botanicals, building on the rich tradition and fermented folklore of hop-free brewing.
Learn more about their delicious section of brews and where to find them at herbiary.com.
In 1909, California passed a eugenics law that allowed for the sterilization of people considered to be, quote, unfit or feeble-minded, unquote. And I know that you two both recently had Beyond Reproach on your podcast, and they talked about the Buck v. Bell Supreme Court case. And so a lot of that is going to come up in here.
Yeah. Why do all of our podcast friends, keep coming on and talking about forced sterilization?
I know. Sorry about that. It wasn't a planned effort. Now, of the 20,000 people that were forcibly sterilized in California between the years of 1909 and 1979, it was found that Latinas carried a nearly 60% higher risk of forced sterilization than any other racial group. Perhaps one of the most devastating things about this dark chapter in history are the heartbreaking stories of numerous women attempting to get pregnant, not realizing that they had been sterilized. In particular, there was a groundbreaking class action lawsuit in the 1970s that 10 Latina women would bring forward, proving that they had been coerced into signing what many of them did not realize was a sterilization consent form. Due to a language barrier and the fact that some of these women were forced to sign this form while they were literally in labor, many of them did not realize that they had been sterilized until weeks and months later. Some of them didn't realize it until they were attempting to get pregnant again.
Yeah. Now, today we, again, will be focusing primarily on California and sterilization of Latina women in California throughout the 20th century. But that isn't to ignore the horrendous stories of Black and Indigenous women, as well as women with disabilities that were also forcibly sterilized at the time. Additionally, our topic does have a narrow focus on California because, for one, it's our home state, like we mentioned, which, you know, we have a love-hate relationship with, but also because California made up 80% of the sterilizations throughout the U.S. during this time period. We do, however, insane. And I don't know that a lot of people know this, we'll get into it, but eugenics in California at this time was insane. We do, however, want to acknowledge that harmful eugenics laws were passed throughout the U.S. and affected tens of thousands of people nationwide, despite today's episode being more focused on California.
Was there also, I wonder how much that percentage of forced sterilizations at the time correlates also to the distribution of the Latinx community at that time as well? Like, how much of the Latina population was also in California, and then there's like the overlap kind of those two.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely had something to do with it. Obviously, mm-hmm. California has a huge Latinx Hispanic population, especially, and at that time, even more so than the rest of the country. But I think it also has very much to do with the fact that there was a huge eugenics movement in California at the time as well, like much more so than the rest of the U.S.
When I think of forced sterilization and eugenics, I don't think about it a lot. It's not just always on the front of my mind, by the way, first of all. That was a weird set. But there was a famous, and I can never remember exactly where it was, but it was in the South. I thought it was 20s, 30s, maybe it was like the 40s or 50s, of African-American populations. Maybe it was North Carolina or Alabama. I know there was one that, and it's probably just one that people tend to hone in on when they're like, you know, clickbait stuff. And so I'm like, oh, that was, you know, in the South, especially when eugenics took off, I always think of it located closer to southeast mm-hmm. corner of America. So it's shocking to me to hear that, I mean, that it's majority in California.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we actually wanted to talk about this on your podcast, because it's something that we've already covered on our own, but we feel it needs more socialization. It needs to be told more, because there are so many people that don't know about it. And I think because California does have, you know, a reputation of being progressive, progressive also meant that we were on the forefront of breaking scientific technologies, and at that time was eugenics. So I think a lot of people, because of the reputation that California has as being more progressive and liberal and science forward, they don't know these things. But all of that kind of played hand in hand in why California had such high rates of eugenics versus the other states throughout the nation. So I think, oh, go ahead.
And a lot of times I feel like progressivism is used to forgive the sins of the past when, and instead of recognizing and speaking to them, it's like, but look how good we are now, even though we're never.
Exactly. No, I think that goes perfectly into why not many people know about this topic, because it, in California in particular, it can, I don't necessarily want to use the word easily, but easily is the word that comes to mind. It can be easily covered, masked by the other accomplishments and our other politics here. So I think the best place for us to start is the history of eugenics here in the United States. And again, this topic that we're covering today, it's a really narrow focus. It's focusing on its history here in the States, and more specifically in California. The direct definition of eugenics from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary is as follows, quote, "The practice or advocacy of controlled selective breeding of human populations, as by sterilization, to improve the population's genetic composition," unquote. Or, in the words of Francis Galton, a major pioneer of the movement, eugenics is, quote, "the study of all agencies under human control which can improve or impair the racial quality of future generations," unquote. So essentially, to kind of sum that all down, it's the practice of eradicating, quote unquote, undesirable qualities and traits. And at this time, such undesirable qualities and traits included, and this is direct language from early eugenicists. Obviously, this is not me listing off what I view as undesirable traits. Early eugenicists, these traits for them were things like mental illness, disabilities, tendencies for drug or alcohol abuse, tendencies to be a criminal, even things like poverty made someone lesser than.
Now, this may all sound really familiar when we think of Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust and the Nazis, but here's the thing. Many of the eugenics ideas that Nazi Germany got, they got from here in the States. More specifically, they got from here in California. In fact, a leading financier of the eugenics movement here in California sent along details of the program to Dr. Fritz Lenz, who was a leading Nazi eugenicist in 1937. When Lenz wrote back, he said, quote, "You were so kind to send new information about sterilization particulars in California. These practical experiences are also very, very valuable for us in Germany. For this, I thank you." End quote.
Also, I think the two most disgusting words I've ever heard next to each other are racial quality. Eugenics just freaks me out so much.
Oh, it's gross. It's just gross.
And like it's so, I hate how progressive at the time and like forefront of science and like, oh, we're doing such great things. I'm like, oh my God, you guys, stop. Yeah.
And really how illogical it was that there was just this giant blanket thrown over, you know, for the term feeble-minded, that really anyone that you wanted could fall under that umbrella.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just entirely illogical.
It was like a weird witch hunt of like, oh my God, my neighbor Natalie hates Oxford commas. She's pretty feeble-minded. Let's sterilize her.
I do think that I saw that as a definition in the dictionary for this. For certain.
They are like such arbitrary things though. Or, I mean, a lot of them designated as feeble-minded were things we just didn't know enough about. diseases or disabilities, but it truly mm-hmm. was just like, this person's a little odd. Let's throw them in an institution and say feeble-minded.
Yeah.
Instead of helping anyone. Yep.
Well, and Cass, to what you said about, and it was North Carolina. I mean, I believe the case that you're talking about is the forced sterilizations in North Carolina that I believe are from, like, the ones that they studied were from, like, the 20s to, like, the 70s.
Yes. Like, how long it went on, that's bizarre. Well,
and a lot of them were, the law, the sterilization law in North Carolina extended to people on public welfare. So basically it was also, like you girls said, the you're not contributing, quote unquote, you're not a contributing member of the labor force, like that, then you're considered, quote, surplus population.
Yeah.
I mean, they were close, but they didn't nail it. It's systemic, not genetic poverty. You know, we can fix this with, you know, government subsidies and help, not fucking sterilization. Sorry. That's a crazy thought, you know.
Oh, no.
Help people below the poverty line.
And I appreciate the rage because we've barely dived into this.
Oh, shit. Oh, man.
We've only just started.
Yeah. Now, just to bring it a little even closer to home, for us, we actually live in Sacramento, California, and still to this day, we have some parks and streets named after these eugenicist leaders, including most prominently Charles Gaty, who was a white supremacist and eugenicist, who was also personally thanked by Nazi Germany for passing along his knowledge in the eugenics fields. Like, for instance, our arboretum and our university used to be called the Gaty Arboretum. We have multiple roads. There used to be Gaty Park, and it's just slowly they're being changed and updated, but there are still some holdouts.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt again, but I
Please
love...
Please do.
Could you imagine your legacy being personally thanked by Adolf Hitler?
Yes.
Ooh.
And a lovely thank you card. It was scented, embossed.
Not great. So sterilization was the common eugenics practice that was used to essentially breed out people with these less desirable traits. Because we're going to be talking about female sterilization so much, I thought it important to discuss what exactly female sterilization is and how it's performed. I'm not going to get all technical and medical here. No heavy details. I'm going to make this kind of quick. But essentially, female sterilization, which is, you know, often more casually referred to as getting your tubes tied, is the procedure in which you block the fallopian tubes by cutting or sealing them. This procedure is nearly 100% effective at ensuring that you will never get pregnant again, and it is not easily successfully reversible. So I don't want to say it is 100% impossible to reverse female sterilization, because of course we've all heard those crazy, very, very few and very far between stories where they can, but it is incredibly rare. The odds of getting pregnant after having your tubes tied is less than 1%. Female sterilization is intended to be permanent, and for the vast majority of people, it cannot be reversed.
This is where we say, not a doctor.
Yes, not a doctor. This is from my WebMD research. So like I already shared, or like Leah shared, 80% of sterilizations as part of the eugenics movement happened here in California. While Indiana was the first state to enact sterilization laws, California was not far behind it.
Fucking
Indiana.
Sorry, I just needed to yell shocker after Indiana.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I know, we could have placed bets. On April 26th, 1909, California became the third state to institute sterilization laws. The first set of laws allowed for state institutions, so things like prisons and hospitals, to sterilize those who were deemed, again, quote unquote, unfit or feeble-minded. In hospitals, this oftentimes meant the sterilization of those that were mentally ill. For prisons, this oftentimes meant sex offenders, repeat offenders, and prisoners with life sentences.
Yeah. And once again, this is the part where I'm just going to once again talk about what constituted, quote, feeble-minded, which we already pretty much outlined it, but it was a catch-all term used by eugenicists to describe anyone that perhaps had abnormal behavior, maybe a low IQ, maybe a woman who was very emotional, you know, anything like that. It could extend to someone with mental illness, someone living in poverty, someone with social dependency, all of the above. Even people who were considered quote unquote promiscuous. So feeble-minded people were one of the biggest concerns for eugenicists, as they believed that these people could be anywhere lurking.
We did this with Beyond Reproach, mm-hmm. But I would like to do it again. Based on any of those things, everyone, since podcasting is a visual medium, raise your hand if you technically qualify as feeble-minded.
No, oh, I was just going to say...
Listeners! I didn't mean to steal that from you.
No, I was just going to say... No, I wasn't going to say that exact thing, but I'm pretty sure when we covered this on our podcast, I said, by these rules, you and I are feeble-minded, you know?
You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's not. Jeez, yeah. Yes. Except straight white men.
Of course.
So the fear was that these feeble-minded people would be lurking and that they would pass off their abnormal behavior when they reproduced with a normal person and then create even more undesirable bloodlines. So, ew, moving on.
and I'm going to bring this, we just, the episode before this one, we talk a lot about abortion rights in America specifically, and I brought up that anti-abortion legislation is kind of directly tied to the witch hunts, like all of this, every violence against women in general you could draw a straight line back to the witch hunts, because any excuse for an act of violence against women who are deemed scary, whether for their independence or mm-hmm. for their differences.
Natalie, what does witch stand for?
Women in total control
of herself.
Yes,
that's my new favorite song right now.
Right, but it's so true. The people that were targeted, I mean, from the witch hunts, and were women who were just like, I'm existing,
independently. Yeah,
and then extended to any other woman or threatening feature. Mm-hmm. Yep. Sorry, I'm not angry. I'm not angry at you two. I just want everyone to know that. But your story is bringing me rage, and I thank you for that.
So on June 13th, 1913, the sterilization laws were expanded to include anyone who was, quote, afflicted with hereditary insanity or incurable chronic mania or dementia, unquote. Parental consent was oftentimes sought by the medical providers before performing sterilization on minors, but it wasn't required. And I want us to look at that sentence one more time and repeat important elements of it so we can make sure we picked up on everything I said. These sterilization procedures were being conducted on minors. The third and final sterilization law in California was enacted in July of 1917, and yet again created further expansion on the previously instated sterilization laws. These eugenics laws would remain in place until 1979.
Now, one of the largest reasons why California was so much at the forefront of this is because we had so much money and effort and resources, really, that was put behind the eugenics education here. For instance, in 1928 in Pasadena, an organization called the Human Betterment Foundation was established, and this foundation's sole purpose was to produce scientific data to educate and demonstrate to naysayers the benefits of eugenic sterilization. So propelling this foundation were some of the nation's leading scientists and educators at the time that relayed their pro-eugenics messages to these libraries, town halls, even to schools.
So as this movement progressed, now that we've, you know, done the history on eugenics in the United States and specifically in California, why were Latinas so disproportionately targeted? Researchers from the University of Illinois and the University of Michigan found that, quote, biases against Mexicans and Mexican Americans were especially prominent. Institutional authorities described Mexicans and their descendants as immigrants of an undesirable type and speculated that they were at a lower racial level than is found among American whites, unquote. Further, Stanford professor and eugenicist Lewis Terman was quoted in 1926 as saying that low intelligence was, quote, very common among Spanish, Indian, and Mexican families of the Southwest. Their dullness seems to be racial, or at least inherent in the family stocks from which they come, unquote.
Ugh.
It's the worst.
I also love how so much of, like, quote-unquote unintelligence is literally just language barriers.
That's what I was literally about to say that exact same thing. We're on the same page here. It's just
cool.
If you have a student whose first language is Spanish, doesn't speak a lot of English, they're not going to be able to perform well or have a high IQ if they're being tested and communicated to in a language that they don't fully understand yet.
But also, you know, so many people, so many Latinx people in America are bilingual.
Yes.
Oh, and totally, yeah.
Like fluently so. And yes. Some more than others in English, but, like, they still know two full-ass languages.
Yes.
And you're trying to tell me they're unintelligent?
And we can't even agree on a comma.
Yeah,
good
they,
one.
They,
okay,
they
you
can
just,
communicate
you
much
just
better.
You just made me feel better about the comma thing. I feel better now. We've made it over the hostility officially.
Oh,
thank you for that. But yes, I mean, exactly what you're saying is, yeah, they're viewed as unintelligent, perhaps if their second language isn't as fluent as their first, but they can still speak one more language than you can.
Uh-huh.
At a minimum, one more language than you can.
And even if they can only speak one language, they're probably fine in their own language. Of course, anyone sounds dumb if they can't speak your language. They're just making sounds to you, but
right.
That weirdly makes you seem dumb. Like, I don't get it.
It's horrible. To give a specific example of one of the horrendous stories to come out of California, in 1930, there was a 16-year-old Mexican-American girl named Concepcion Ruiz who was arrested for running away with her boyfriend. It was considered to be, quote, subnormal, unquote, that a young woman would have sexual interest in a boy. Enough sexual interest in said boy that she would run away with him. I know, it's an absurd concept. Honestly absurd. But between this subnormal sexual interest and the fact that Ruiz was also reported to have a lower than average IQ score, which could go right back to what you were just saying, Cass, the courts ended up declaring her to be mentally deficient. She was sent to the Sonoma State Home for the Feeble-Minded, and here she was sterilized despite her not giving consent to do so, and despite the fact that she verbally demanded that they not. At only 16 years old, Ruiz underwent an irreversible surgery that she did not consent to and that would forcibly change the course of her life. She would be but one of the 5,000 other people sterilized at Sonoma State Home for the Feeble-Minded, which nearly 20% of the sterilizations performed there at that facility would be men and women of Mexican descent. While Mexican-American men were also victims of the California eugenics movement, Mexican-American women were specifically targeted due to the disgusting stereotypes that Latinas are hypersexual, promiscuous, and that they are more fertile than women from other racial backgrounds.
Now, not only was sterilization in Latina women used as means of stopping the reproduction of, quote, low intelligence offspring, but also to stop the rate at which they were being produced. In other words, it was population control. I also think we need to put into context that anti-immigration and overall anti-Mexican sentiment that there was running concurrently to this mass sterilization. As part of the Immigration Act of 1924, the U.S. Border Patrol was formed. Additionally, during the late 1920s, America was in the midst of the Great Depression with, as we know, white American men accusing men of Mexican descent of stealing American jobs. In fact, during the time of the Great Depression, upwards of 2 million people of Mexican descent were forcibly removed from the U.S., 60% of which were American citizens. Something else that many people don't know is that racial segregation in schools did not exclusively apply to black versus white children. in some cases, it also applied to Latino children. There were restaurants and movie theaters and public pools that would not cater to Latinx Americans. Keeping all of these things in mind can definitely help us further grasp the context of Latina forced sterilization throughout the 20th century, but might not help with the rage.
So you said the Border Patrol was created in the 20s?
Yeah. And
that's the same border control we still have now?
Yeah, in 1924.
So it was, and nothing else in America is, but it was rooted in white supremacy and exists to this day to target Latinx people?
Shocker.
I don't believe it.
Yes, I'm sorry. Are you saying that a police force is rooted in white supremacy?
This is a revolutionary concept, and I'm going to need you to break it down. Go a little slower for some of us that are just learning this new concept here.
You guys, I think we cracked it. I think we figured it out finally.
A group of people that was specifically designed to police the population and bodies of another subsect of people who weren't represented in that task force doing that is rooted in white supremacy?
What?
And I don't know, guys. Exists to this day based on precedents of historical existence?
Wild. I'm constantly learning on this podcast.
I don't know. You guys sound like conspiracy theorists. This is all so off the wall.
Well, it's like, not like
know.
I'm saying the world is round or anything. That'd be wild.
Please, don't be Jesus. Ridiculous. Or that Oxford commas are not necessary.
Well, wow.
Yeah. It's so bad. All of it's bad.
But to what Leah just said about the segregation in schools, Mendez versus Westminster predates Brown versus the Board of Education, and that one was Mexican American forced segregation. So the more you know, go Google it, fam. Yeah.
Are you definitely. Both? Are you both California natives?
Yes.
Yep.
You are. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm from the Midwest. I feel like so much of American history taught in schools when it comes to racial segregation is so focused on North versus South, which is usually kind of hitting that East Coast side. And then when, again, at least in the Midwest, I'm sure you guys got a little bit more because you live there. What I was taught was, you know, we talked about internment, and you know, it was so brief on Western racial segregation and everything. And so I mean, yeah, no one knows about this unless you're from there, or
even when you're from here, this was not taught in schools. Like,
it's wild. Like, I feel like once you hit the Missouri River, it's like everything west of the Rocky Mountains is like still taught as like, you guys are the frontier and the wilderness, and no, we're still mining for gold and everything.
I did do that for many class field trips.
Did you too. Really? Oh,
and it's God. Really, it's like glitter. It's just like gold glitter. Yes. Yeah.
But it's so weird that the way it's still taught is that anything west of the Rockies is first
more
of all,
progressive, or
well, no, it's taught like it is just this empty expanse of still like just kind of cowboys and ranges, and at the same time it's like, oh, it's those progressive liberals in LA, you know. It's like when we teach a history of racism, the Western United States doesn't exist. We mention Japanese internment, but we don't want to talk about that too much.
No, you know.
It takes away from our heroism from World War II.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure when this episode's coming out, so I don't know if I'm giving something away ahead of time with our season or not, but one of the upcoming topics that we're going to be covering is the racist history of Oregon. A lot of people don't know about that either, that Oregon was literally founded on being, like, just a white state. They banned black people.
Drag Oregon to filth.
Yeah. So, it's
Colorado in fucking, not Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged.
But I think it's exactly what you just said is, and yeah. We do the same thing. You know, I don't think it's just the way that it's taught, you know, in the Midwest or East Coast. It's here too. We're taught that because we are so diverse here, we're taught that racism never existed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also like Chicago's super diverse, but is also still one of the most segregated cities. Just by
design.
That's
also true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Guys, can we write the textbooks? I feel like we would fix so many things if just like us four and no one else.
I'm so sorry to bring it up once again, but will the textbooks have Oxford commas? I do think this is something that has to be established early.
Yes, because we can write them in MLA formatting, which requires it.
And if you answered no to that question, we are erasing you from our history.
Oh, it's finally happening.
Oh my God, I'm drunk with power. I get where it comes from now. Revisionist history.
My Leo Sun Pisces Moon nightmare that all of my friends secretly hate me and wish I wasn't here.
Wait, is that a Leo thing? Because I now I get it.
I think
I'm
it's a balance of my Pisces, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's what I love you said about Leo. Horoscopes, because I feel like that's everyone. We're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Everybody.
Also, I truly believe it.
Yeah. Just assuming everybody hates me isn't just me.
Yeah.
At time of recording, it's almost Leo. It's almost Leo season. So yes. Strap in, bitches.
You guys, I saw a meme recently that it was a guy. He's like, "Oh, I was at a party," and a girl was like, "So, like, what's your backstory?" And he was like, "Oh, I have, you know, minor scoliosis," and she was like, "Oh my God, wow, I'm a Scorpio."
Oh my
I'm sorry,
God.
I had to throw
that's
that in
hilarious.
There. Let's talk about forced sterilization some more.
Yeah, let's dig.
Yeah, we could get back to that. We're done with laughing now, I guess.
I feel like scoliosis would be a reason, would just be an excuse for forced sterilization.
Sterilize them.
For sure.
I say that as somebody with scoliosis.
Oh, yeah. One of the most devastating things to come out of the forced sterilization of Latinas came in 1978 when 10 women brought a federal class action lawsuit against the Los Angeles County USC Medical Center, Dr. James Quilligan, health directors, and state departments for sterilizing them without their informed consent.
1978?
Correct. Yes.
What?
1978. And actually, to speak to whether we're taught this kind of stuff in history or not, in 2020, I remember I was watching a reveal of a new exhibition at our California museum here, and it was all virtual because it was in 2020. They couldn't open up the exhibit to everyone, and they mentioned this case in the California museum. There's a whole exhibit about it in 2020. So it took us that long to recognize what had happened to these women, at least in our museums. Yeah, so this was 1978. This case, the case became known as the Madrigal versus Quilligan case. Each of these women have such horrendous and devastating stories, but I do want to highlight a few of them. Beginning with Dolores Madrigal, the named plaintiff in this case, she said that while she was in the hospital in labor with her second child, medical staff approached her multiple times about getting sterilized. She was hesitant, but they assured her that it would be better this way. They told her that her husband had already agreed to the procedure after they had told him that there was a possibility that she could die if she tried to have another kid. Additionally, they lied and told her that the procedure was reversible. Without actually knowing what exactly this form that they kept shoving in her face said, Madrigal signed it. Another one of the plaintiffs, Estella Benavides, had a very similar story. For Rebecca Figueroa and Maria Hurtado, they were under the impression, and might I also add, under the influence of heavy medication, that the forms that were being shoved in their faces were consent forms for the C-section operations that the doctors were about to perform. It would be weeks later when they realized that they had signed consent to be sterilized.
Now, some of the... You were about to say something, Cass.
She was just going to yell.
I was just sighing. I just wanted to yell into the void.
All right. Some of the plaintiffs in this case never even signed consent forms. One woman in particular, Georgina Hernandez, distinctly remembered refusing sterilization multiple times while in labor. Despite this, the doctors just went ahead and sterilized her anyway and would later lie and say that she had totally given them consent and she just couldn't remember due to the excessive pain and bleeding that she was in because she was in labor. Another woman, Maria Figueroa, agreed during labor to be sterilized, but only if her baby was a boy. She ended up giving birth to a girl and the doctor sterilized her anyways. Much like the story of Hernandez, the doctor lied and said that she had given her consent even when she knew for a fact she had not. So, gaslighting. Yay.
I'm shocked, like, truly, I'm shocked they even tried to do, you know, consent forms. Ugh.
Now, some of the women simply gave in after such intense pressure to sign the forms. They were just being, like, barraged with doctors telling them they had to sign these. One particular plaintiff, Javita Rivera, said that while she was in labor with her second child, she was told by the doctor that, quote, I had too many children, that I was poor and a burden to the government, and I should sign a paper not to have more children, unquote. She was also lied to and told that the procedure, once again, could be reversed, and so she decided to go ahead and sign the forms. For other plaintiffs, they were denied pain medication if they didn't sign the form. For others, their babies were denied care if they did not sign the form. But for all of these women, the one thing that they all had in common was that not a single one of them wanted to be sterilized. Under the worst possible circumstances, when in extensive labor pain, given false and untruthful information, and for many of these women, there was also that language barrier that we kind of talked about before, informed consent was simply not possible. In fact, experts have said that when in extreme pain, you can't give informed consent. One of the witnesses for the prosecution in this matter, a handwriting expert, actually compared the signatures of the women on their consent form to their normal everyday signatures and found there to be a drastic difference between the two, indicating that the women had been in excruciating pain and or on heavy medication when they had signed the release forms.
They literally tortured them to get them to sign it.
Like, yeah.
Withholding treatment. And
oh, yeah. Withholding treatment from them, from their newborn baby. I think even their just children. Lying if, yeah. you know, you're the father of the baby's in another room, that because you know they said like the husband in some of these cases was in another room and they would say I got consent from your husband, you're like, oh shit, I guess if he already said yes.
That's like fucked up interrogation tactics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. It's horrible. The most devastating to me in all of this are the stories from these women who did not realize that they had been sterilized, returning to the doctor several weeks or months later and learning then. I cannot even imagine the level of pain and devastation and disappointment to learn that you will never be able to have another baby. An anthropologist who testified during the court case actually talked about the emotional, social, mental, and psychological effects that forced sterilization can have on a woman. A major one being that they lose a sense of self and purpose, which can lead to depression, anxiety, strained relationships, and more.
Making them more feeble-minded. Although her testimony would later be dismissed by the judge due to relevance, one witness for the prosecution did state that she had overheard Dr. Quilligan and others at the hospital perpetuating the harmful stereotypes of Latinx women being hyper-fertile. She also testified that LA County Hospital had received a federal grant if they were able to reduce the birth rate of Mexican and Black Americans in LA. This case was not brought before a jury. Rather, the attorneys on both sides decided they would rather have the judge make the final decision. And you're not going to like the final decision this judge made. Ultimately, Judge Jesse Curtis sided with the hospital, stating that the doctors did not do anything wrong and simply had the patient's best interest in mind when they made these decisions. And the judge said it was fully within the rights of a doctor to, quote, improve a perceived overpopulation problem, unquote.
Cool.
Now that falls within a doctor's purview.
When you talk about generational trauma and certain demographics of people from cultures who don't go to doctors, like there's a large swath of African Americans who are so resistant to going to doctors, and you know, a lot of minorities, whether that be racial or queer or female, who don't go to doctors and don't get the help they need.
It's because of historical distrust.
Of hundreds, literally hundreds, thousands of years of, yeah, distrust of being coerced, of being tortured by the medical profession when it was specifically dominated by white male supremacists. Mm-hmm. And those people, those demographics of people, still don't get the care that they need today.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's
generational.
It's generational trauma. It's learned, you know, fear of don't go to the doctor. Bad shit's going to happen. You know, some people are like, oh, I don't want to go to the dentist. It hurts. Or I want to go to the doctor. I don't want to get a shot. Imagine being like, oh, I don't want to go to the doctor. I don't know why. Maybe because so many of your ancestors were tortured, sterilized, you know, all of this horrible things.
Had experiments performed on you. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and like I mentioned this last week, but obstetrics and gynecology also just like historically since the formalization of medicine, and by that I mean from the white maleification of the medical
I love practice, white maleification.
The white maleification was incredibly dangerous and was where like a ton of not that wasn't considered malpractice because they didn't know better. I'm using scare quotes there, but like doctors and surgeons killed more people in maternity wards than midwives ever did.
Home births. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna keep bringing it back to that. They didn't know to wash their hands. And when someone suggested that they wash their hands, they took it as an insult.
Yes.
As an insult that their hands could be weapons of, like, vectors of death and could pass disease.
Even when their male colleagues
didn't wash it.
Yeah, right?
Can you imagine that ego of, like, somebody like, oh, do you wash your hands? Like, no. And I'm going to continue to not because you said that.
This sounds like creepily relevant to today's society of people that even when it's in their 100% best interest backed by science, will still refuse.
Even when it's backed by science and brought up by somebody who does actually look like them.
And in this particular case too, just something you said made me think of it is how systemic this issue is, in that all the way up to the judge siding with the doctor saying, oh no, it is 100% within a doctor's rights to improve what is perceived as an overpopulation problem. That, you know, it, like you were saying, the propaganda, the motivation to get rid of a population of people that they no longer wanted goes all the way up to the court. Yeah, who gives anyone the right to for a quote directly from the judge again, to improve a perceived overpopulation problem?
A perceived being, that being the main thing I'm taking from that, a perceived overpopulation problem. It's not even, yeah.
And yet you're citing fact, you're citing scientific fact, which is not founded, and you're still using the word perceived.
Yeah.
I bet that judge was feeble-minded.
He probably used the or didn't use the Oxford comma.
Did not. Oh, absolutely not.
100%. Sorry, Nat. 100% didn't use it.
Absolutely sorry. Not. Sorry, we keep making.
Or what if it was like in the ruling? He does the opposite of that. It's like improve comma a comma perceived comma overpopulation comma comma space space problem.
Oh my god.
Space space. Yeah. I'm gonna pull up the transcript.
Yeah. ultimately, this judge, Mr. Oxford, comma, decided that this had all simply been a miscommunication. So while these women would never receive legal justice, nor would they ever be able to conceive again, there were some legacies that came out of this trial that we can say cheers to, I guess. It was this trial that led to forms in hospitals being translated into multiple languages, as well as a new policy put in place that patients under the age of 21 were given 72 hours before making any decisions about sterilization. It also should be noted that a lot of hospitals utilize the services of translators now as well. And in 2018, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors issued a formal apology to the women. So took how many years?
In 1927. Whoa, I'm trying to throw us way back. In 1979, not long after the Madrigal versus Quilligan case was settled, the practice of forced sterilizations throughout the state of California was officially abolished. By the time it was all over, some 20,000 women had been forcibly sterilized. Despite the practice being abolished, California still saw instances of it in state prisons afterward. Between the years of 2006 and 2010, an audit found that 144 women in state prisons had been illegally sterilized without their consent. It is estimated that there were about 100 other women that were also illegally sterilized while in prison in the late 1990s. In March of 2003, former California Governor Gray Davis made a formal apology for the state's involvement in the eugenics movement. And in June of 2021, our current California Governor Gavin Newsom, Daddy Newsom as we affectionately call him, approved $7.5 million for reparations for all survivors of forced or involuntary sterilization.
I'm sorry, I just
between the years of 1909. Oh, no.
Sorry, that was inappropriate. I just,
it's like,
you know,
I think that was a good sound, right?
No, that was a good sound.
Was it for the
reparations?
But was just, it for the reparations or for Daddy or for Daddy Newsom?
It was for the reparations.
It was for the reparations, yeah. And now I understand why you call him Daddy Newsom.
Yeah. So they did get these reparations for all survivors of forced or involuntary sterilization between the years of 1909 and 1979, as well as survivors of any forced sterilizations performed in prisons after 1979. And
so
that
Daddy
is
Newsom.
Our awful, tragic story.
Yeah.
First of all, can I say that reparations for everybody, first of all, belated sorries suck, and they can be very just
more upsetting than letting it be. Almost.
We're just saying this to say it.
Yep. Yeah.
But you know what? Say it anyway.
Yeah.
Fucking yep. Say you're sorry. Back it up. And yeah.
With things like reparations.
Yeah.
Like reparations.
So you were not maybe you were not in a seat of power or directly responsible for the thing that happened,
yeah.
You are in the position you are in because of the thing that happened. You are directly benefiting from the thing that happened, and you are in power now. So fucking do something about it.
And the government you're representing
did terrible things,
and so it's literally your job to.
Well, it's like on the topic of. Well, not on the topic of forced sterilization, but on the topic of eugenics, pregnancy, and like taking responsibility for the past, like Planned Parenthood advocates for the removal of Margaret Sanger's name from things because she was a eugenicist, and they're like, yep, there were great contributions to reproductive rights and access to contraception, but also we very racist, and also it came from a place of eugenics, of let's mm-hmm. get some more contraception towards people of like low income or minority or immigrant backgrounds, because we want to stop those pregnancies.
When we talk about generational trauma, I see so many things on Instagram and people and things from my friends and whatnot of like, let's stop generational trauma within our own community. Let's be the person who makes the change within our mm-hmm. own community. And like, that's mm-hmm. great. Challenging, you know, cultural norms within a specific subset. But a lot of that generational trauma was born from white supremacy. And that's just another instance of putting it on the person or the people who have been maligned to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And something mm-hmm. as simple and really doesn't do anything as an official apology, it does matter if you back it up with something, you know, because mm-hmm. you're setting a precedent. You're setting a precedent that this was not okay. We're not going to do it again. If you lay that foundation and that groundwork, and that's how you stop generational trauma. Stop traumatizing people, and they won't live in that trauma anymore.
And stop making it their responsibility to climb out of it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Of the hole that they didn't dig.
Yes, exactly. We had an episode about the stolen generation of the Aboriginal people in Australia who were mm-hmm. until the 80s had children stolen and adopted to integrate into white society. And there is a national sorry day in Australia. Mm-hmm. And Australia Day is still the day that, you know, Captain Cook, quote unquote, discovered Australia, which like, you know, not great, but there's a push to make National Sorry Day Australia Day. But the fact that the whole country mm-hmm. celebrates one day of being like, y'all, we fucked up. That may not have fixed everything or anything, but recognizing faults as a country is so, so important.
Mm-hmm. At a very minimum, it's a yearly reminder to acknowledge the hurt and the pain and the generational trauma that exists there. And I think one thing that you said that's really important too is when you make an apology, you know, words only go so far, actions go further. And that is part of what leads to generational trauma, is like, it's not, history is not in the past. History, I mean, I don't know how to say that more eloquently, but the fact that we're talking about these sorts of things today and they're relevant and they pertain to what we are going through today, that's a problem. When we talk about, you know, the racism that Black Americans have faced and the mass incarceration that Black Americans face, when we talk about that in a historical perspective, but we still see it every single day, that's a problem. When we talk about Japanese detention camps and there's still so much racism against Asian Americans, that today, that's a problem. That's why these things continue to persist, is because they don't get remedied.
We would not be this angry talking about history if it weren't still going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably why the Oxford comma thing is so fresh. I'm sorry.
She's trying to lighten the mood. But certainly, I think what you're saying is exactly right. Yes. Like, if we saw this story, we'd be like, ew, gross, California. That is so nasty of you that you did that. Thank God we've come so far from
what
that.
What a ridiculous story. It would be one of those. Like, oh my God, that's bizarre. What the hell?
Yeah.
But the fact that we're angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leah and I actually, we just recently released an episode about historical torture techniques. So, you know, like just like the Iron Maiden and thumb screws and like just crazy stuff, right? And I know it's so gross.
I love it, but
one of the things that Leah said, which goes right That's what we said too. We love it and hate it. Made us squeamish the whole time, but so fascinating. But what Leah said, the reason why she thinks it's so fascinating, why even though it's gross, but we're still like almost, I don't want to say entertained, but fascinated by it, is because it is so illogical, because it is so far in the past, because it is so crazy and something we would never do now, is why we're able to almost look at it with like a morbid fascination. Mm-hmm. But we can't do that here when we still see examples of these things every single day.
And that is why it's so important to talk about history that we know about, but we don't know about. Mm-hmm. Like we have those, mm-hmm. oh, we know there was forced sterilization in this one specific instance in this whatever, this footnote yeah. that we get in a whatever. But something that was so close to our country in California, in the country mm-hmm. I live in, but that yep. California is seemingly this other world, or the West is this other world. And when we're taught history, we think of California as frontier. And it's,
yeah.
and when we think of present, we think of California as like, oh, you know, like you said, progressive and yada, yada, like, but they're not fully, and their history is not. And we, no. it's not that far mm-hmm. ago.
78.
We can't separate no, not at that all. As like, you know, tall tales and way back whens.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. I mean, if this practice of forced sterilization in California was not officially abolished until 1979, and then even after that, all the way up till at least that we know of 2010, there were still women in state prisons that were being illegally sterilized even after it was officially abolished. So it just continues.
Yeah.
So yay.
Yay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'd like to.
I mean, yay that we finally yeah. had you guys on, but not.
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah.
Not yay about the last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Natalie,
no. Hour.
On behalf of me, Leah and Rachel, I'm geez. Speaking for them. We would like to thank you for opposing the Oxford comma, because it is the only way we've been able to bring a morsel of levity throughout this entire
episode. It's honestly true. It's true.
You're absolutely right. I'm so glad that that happened. Yeah. I am now grateful that that happened.
Thank you for being our sacrificial lamb, Natalie.
I'm glad to serve a purpose. It's not often that I feel like I have, so I'm happy to provide this service. Rachel, Leah, tell everybody how, well, you know, no, don't tell anyone anything until I get to learn another thing from you. Columbus didn't discover shit, but we all make so many discoveries that we can claim as our own all the time. So I would like to invite you to plant a flag in a great discovery that you have made recently, that you made. Nobody's ever heard of this or seen this before. Not before you guys.
Yeah. So I discovered, well, I was the first. I am the first to discover the Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. I know no one has heard of this book, even though it is right now like a bestseller.
I'm pretty
are both
sure
you looking
was...
at me like you haven't heard of it?
Thanks to you.
I haven't.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Pretty sure it's an, like on like, the Oprah you, book club.
If you look
something.
Up like.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, Rachel put it there.
I essentially wrote it. but if anyone needs a good read, it was really great. I just finished it like a week ago and I'm still talking about it because I was pleasantly surprised by it because it is like one of the most popular books out there right now. I find that those books are like most popular books are sometimes kind of trashy. Like they're just like easy, breezy reads. But this one actually had some really good depth in the characters and it was very good. If anyone needs a read, Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo.
Not to be confused with the Seven and a Half Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, a book that came
oh
up around the same time. Also very, very good. But what a confusing
wow.
title really conundrum. Is.
All right. I did not discover that other one.
I have that book waiting for, I'm waiting for my hold to come in from the library. Thank you to Rachel's discovery and recommendation.
Could you imagine certainly. If she hadn't told you that?
I put it there at that library. Yeah.
Thank you.
My discovery is history related, and I just found this out on TikTok. If anybody's into like royal history, which I shamefully am kind of, apparently Prince William will be the first direct descendant of Charles II, who was the last Stuart king in the 17th century to rule the UK. So when he becomes king, he is going to be the nearest descendant to the Stuart throne. That
Jacobites unite!
Yes!
Thank you, Outlander, for teaching me about Jacobites.
Yes, he's more British than his daddy is, apparently. Because,
what? How? Yeah.
So after Charles II couldn't produce an heir, and so it just went on this little like side scurry where his sister or brother became the ruler, and then somebody else did it, and then none of them could have children. So they ended up bringing like German blood into the bloodline.
Just a quick genetic side quest. Yeah.
And so most of the current family, they actually are like come from Germanic descendants and are actually from like the German bloodline. But Princess Diana apparently is descended directly from the Stuart bloodline. So when she
suck it, Charles, Diana did it.
Isn't that cool?
I want a shirt. I want a shirt that all it says is Diana did it.
Oh,
I love that.
Oh my God, that's my favorite. Like, I'm gonna say my discovery's better, but it's
a close
maybe
second.
It's only because it's silly, okay. And really, it's not better at all. That blew my mind. I'm obsessed with that kind. Oh my God!
Yeah,
I'm watching Outlander again. The reason why mine is better is my discovery is a new show on Netflix called How to Build a Sex Room. So like, how could you top that?
I just saw that. It was on my recommendations, and I was like, what?
I've never heard of it.
It's new. It just came out.
I had a friend staying in town, and we just saw the title, and I was like joking, like, how to build a sex room? We have to watch that.
What's it actually? Is it actually
it's
about
like
building a sex room?
Straight like, what's up about? Property Brothers HGTV. We're going to renovate a room in your house, but it is this fantastically quirky British woman named Melanie Rose, who is just like,
oh,
she builds a sex room. She's like, what kind of stuff do you like? Are we looking for a dungeon? Are we looking for a sensual getaway? Let me go into my dirty bag of tricks. And she brings out like a bag of like whips and dildos. She's like, do you like this? What do you think of this? And it's phenomenal. And it's,
I love this.
It's
I
weirdly
believe it.
So wholesome.
Oh, I feel
because
like it has to
it
be.
Ends up
I don't
being
know,
these
like
couples like communicating. Like it becomes so like therapeutic and like talking about this really vulnerable thing and finding ways to be open about it, and like it's like, "Oh my God, you want to like tie up and flog each other and talk about your like emotional boundaries and the way you connect to each other as oh my God." It's
I love
hilarious,
this.
Sexy, and wholesome. Oh which how can you
I
put
love
those
it.
Three words together?
With an Oxford comma.
With the Oxford comma.
That is how you would put those three items in one sentence.
Oh, it's almost like you could put them in a sentence without the Oxford comma, and it would still make sense because none of them are complicated things. I would like to retitle that show Love It, List It, or Lick It.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Very clever. Very clever. Small, small copyright infringement, but still very clever.
It's fine.
No, it'll be fine. Who's going to stop me? I'll put the comma in a different spot. My discovery also ties really nicely into sex and breeding. I was blessed this morning. I met and discovered a pit bull wiener dog mix, and he was very handsome, and I got lost into the chocolatey pools of his eyes.
Oh.
And did you take him home?
I bent down to pet him and he hugged me. And so now I'm invincible.
Natalie texted me today and says, quote, I met a pit bull wiener dog mix this morning and he hugged me when I pet him. So we are blessed today.
Oh,
and I
we are blessed.
That is a sure sign.
What does a pit bull wiener dog look like?
I wish you had taken a photo because I want to know as well.
It looks like a corgi shaped pit bull. It looks like you took a pit bull. You chopped his legs off at
the knees. I just found a picture and I'm about to die.
And then you
hold
just
on.
Stretched
the
butt
out
a little
bit.
Stop it right now.
It's not even blended.
Okay. It literally just looks like you cut the head off of a pit bull and put it on a wiener dog.
Stop it.
Oh, he's so perfect. Hi, buddy.
Oh, man.
I would have never known that mix existed, except for you. So you really did discover it.
And it hugged you.
Yeah, he jumped up on my leg, and I was like, I'm not going to stop you. And I pet him. He kind of like smooshed into me when I pet him, and his tiny little legs went around my leg, and I was like,
I always feel bad because I know when dogs jump and owners are like, don't jump. They're doing it because they're like working on the dog not jumping, but I'm always like, no, it's fine. It's okay.
Yeah, I'm like, please jump.
this guy's dad did not even try to stop him. I also did the thing where I asked, I said, because they had kind of veered off of the sidewalk as I approached. And so I was like, oh, maybe he's like trying not to make the dog deal with people. And so I just said, I was like, is that a pit bull dachshund mix? And he's like, yes, it is. And I said,
did you whisper it like that?
And, yes. I was like, can I pet him? And he goes, he's like, oh yeah, he's super friendly. And I wanted to be like, never for a moment did I doubt that this thing was
friendly.
Of course
not. Did you see it? Look at him.
I'm like, never for a moment. I just wanted to get your consent before I pet your dog.
I'm sorry, everyone else. That was the best discovery. So
podcasting is a visual medium. But in case, you know, you can't see into our mind's eye what this dog looks like, we'll post a picture.
Yeah.
We'll link a photo below in the show description, along with a bunch of other visual aids from Leah and Rachel's story. And also you can find all of those on Instagram at SharedPod. Leah and Rachel, where can everyone find and follow you?
You can find us on Instagram at #history_podcast, or our website is #history-pod.com. Those are our most active sites, or like things that we update the most often. We are also on TikTok at #history, but we don't post very often, if I'm going to be
honest. We have a presence there. It's just not a very loud presence.
We're present. Mm-hmm.
That's fair. It's a lot of work. The youths just have more time.
They do.
Yeah.
The rest of us have full-time jobs.
I mean, I have plenty of time to watch TikToks. I just don't have it. I don't want to make them.
Yeah, it seems I always have time to watch.
Right.
Everyone go listen to #history. We absolutely adore them. And give them a follow. And man, just have a great day.
You too.
And do better, America.
Yeah.
Until next time.
Share you later.
Share you later.